supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later in the show, we're going to link a recent news event to something we need to tell you every fall. This time, it's a real object lesson in why you should not be overfeeding your lawn or feeding it unnecessary chemicals, unless you want to wind up like Toledo and have the National Guard be bringing you the only stuff that's safe to drink. You won't want to miss it. And you won't. It's coming up after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dean, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Dean. How are you?
Great, great. And yourself, Mike?
I am doing just fine, sir. Where is Dean Great?
Currently, I'm in Voorhees, New Jersey.
Okay, but does that mean that's not the site of your question?
I have a beach house on Long Beach Island, and I had the same issue there as I have with my garden here in Voorhees.
And what's the issue?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was I have a blossom end rot on both my plants, my tomato plants up here and at the beach. I was noticing that the first tomatoes of the season had the blossom end rot. And I was just wondering, I thought perhaps it was something that had to do with the climate itself, and the climates are typically different here, between here and the beach. And I wasn't sure if it was a climate issue or if there was some other issue which was causing the blossom end rot on my tomatoes.
What part of the climate has been the same in both New Jersey locations, Dean?
I don't know. I mean, they both...
Do you own an umbrella, Dean?
Yes, I do, but I don't use it.
Yeah, well, then you've been darn wet this year, pal. Because we have had a record amount of rain. And so the plants have been constantly saturated. Tomato plants are unusual in that they like even watering. They do not like long dry periods followed by long wet periods. And one of the things that happens is as they are ripening, their blossom end, that's where the flower used to be, the hiney of the tomato, as they begin to ripen up, because of the uneven watering, that part of the skin does not have the structural integrity to hold up, starts to fall apart, turns black, and rots. And this is the time of year we get tons of calls about this. And I'm happy to tell people that at least it's not a pest or a disease problem. Right. It's a cultural problem, like opera, like this radio show.
Yes.
Except unlike those cultural problems, there's a cure. And that is adequate soil calcium. What I tell people to do, especially people who eat eggs as part of their diet, is whenever you make your eggs, save the eggshells in the carton. Just keep putting the shells back in the carton. When there's no fresh eggs left, you know, let the carton dry out, open it up, leave it sit out on your kitchen counter. It's very attractive home decorating. And then after a couple of days, put it aside someplace where you're going to find it in the spring. And as you put your tomato plants in the ground, crush up a dozen dried eggshells and drop them right on top of the root ball.
Wow.
You dig a deep hole, you pull the bottom leaves off the tomato, you drop the tomato plant in the ground, you crush up the eggshells on top, then you fill in the hole. Now, I don't care if you're a flat earth gardener, a raised bed gardener, a container gardener, and I'm not saying 30 other things won't go wrong, but
right.
You do that one simple thing and you'll never see blossom end rot.
Wow, excellent. I will give that a shot.
And if you don't eat eggs, there are organic fertilizers. Any organic tomato fertilizer will contain an awesome amount of calcium. Most of them are like 7 to 10% calcium. So, it's knocked out.
Yeah.
So, and I believe there is, for people like you, a liquid spray that you can try mid-season that hopefully will get the calcium into the cellular structure of the plant fast, because it's too late to add an element like that to the soil. You got to do something faster. But
right.
You will find in better gardening centers calcium sprays designed for tomatoes to prevent blossom end rot. Get one of these calcium sprays, but pull off all the tomatoes you have that have this rot on the bottom, because it won't improve them. It'll just help the new ones. So, and then obviously be ready next year to prevent this completely.
Right. Okay, great.
All right, Dean?
Appreciate that. Thanks, Mike.
My pleasure, sir. Take care.
Sure now.
1-888-346-9499. Jennifer, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
And where is Jennifer very well?
I am very well in North Wilmington, Delaware.
Very good, very good. What can we do for Jennifer in Wilmington?
Well, I need some intervention to keep me chemical-free because I have got a bad desire to go out and buy some herbicides to deal with the plantains that are just invading my lawn to such a degree that they're taking over.
Now, I have to make fun of you, but it's a transposition of something a listener did to me about 6 months ago. Oh my God, you mean you've got gigantic banana trees growing up out of your lawn?
No, not quite. These are nasty weeds that want to go to seed every week between cuttings.
Right, and they are broadleaf weeds that have a spindly, ropey thing coming up the center. And everyone in America calls them plantains, the same as the banana-like fruit. And I was corrected, what a shock, that the actual pronunciation is something akin to plantain. But anyway, we all know what you mean. You have a broadleaf weed. Now, I'll just go over the basics with you. Who cuts your lawn?
My husband.
And how high is it when he's done cutting it?
I would say he's cutting it to no less than 4 inches.
That would be unusual. As long as that lawn is 3 inches high, presuming you have a cool season grass, which predominates in 3 inches high should be enough to crowd out weeds. Is this a shaded area? Are there trees?
Yes, we do have a lot of shade.
So,
already in the suboptimal conditions for the grass.
Right. So here's what's going on. Because you have a lot of shade, that means, by almost definition, the grass you have is a variety of fescue.
Mm-hmm.
Fescues are cool season grasses that do well in the north and the mid-Atlantic, and they can tolerate much more shade than bluegrass, but they are clumping grasses that can't fill in their own bare spots. You make a big divot in bluegrass, and it'll run sideways to cover the hole. Any damage done to a fescue needs to be repaired. So your timing is perfect, first of all. Because one of the issues, you have bare spots in your lawn, let's be honest, right?
Right, we do.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you haven't replanted grass there, nature thinks it's for her.
Okay.
So here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to take a section of your lawn and dig up like a 6-inch by 6-inch section and contact the Delaware Center for Horticulture, which is a great resource in your community, and tell them you have a lawn grass that needs to be identified. Because what you most need to do, like right now, over the next month, is buy seed that matches your existing grass. And then whether you kill the plantains or not beforehand, you want to have a big load of compost dumped over your lawn, and you want to spread that matching seed throughout the area where the weeds are or were, and fill in those bare spots. Then if you cut that high, the new grass will merge with the old grass, will match up. You have to be careful that it matches in color and blade shape. And that'll be a barrier to entry against new weeds. Now, you have two choices if you want to do some knockdowns of the existing weeds.
Mm-hmm.
One is a great new organic herbicide. It's an herbicide based on iron. Gardens Alive, for instance, they sell it as Iron X. Iron is actually good for lawns. Iron has long been used to green up lawns. So you spray it on a broadleaf weed, however, and it kills the broadleaf weed, does no damage to the lawn, and you could be sowing seed at almost the same time. Your other option would be to really soak the lawn thoroughly and pull up as many of these menaces as you could right before reseeding.
Right.
But the important thing to note is these weeds are not really the sign of a weed problem. They're the sign that you have fescue grass that you haven't overseeded to fill in bare spots. And that's the price you pay for having a lawn in shade. You know, it grows slower. You don't need to feed it as much. But you do need to spread matching seed every couple of years. And the ideal time to spread that seed is August 15th to the end of September.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much, Mike. This is really useful.
Good luck, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a free composting workshop on Wednesday evening, September 10th, at the Phoenixville Country Club in Phoenixville, PA. I'll help you turn your soon-to-be-abundant fall leaves and maybe even some of your kitchen waste into fabulous food and mulch for your lawn, landscape, and garden plants. That's a free event, Wednesday, September 10th at 7:30 at the Phoenixville Country Club. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to feed your lawn for the fall without turning your drinking water green. Wouldn't that be a nice idea? I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, Toledo's drinking water turned green and was undrinkable for several days earlier this month. What caused it? Lawn fertilizers. Let's not be like Toledo. Later in the show, I'll be telling you how to fertilize your lawn safely and sanely. In the meantime, though, lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing today?
I am doing just fine. John, how are you, sir?
I'm fine. A little damp. We've had a lot of rain, but I'm fine.
And where is John damp?
I'm in Haines, Alaska.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, Haines is in southeast Alaska, right?
Yes, it is. We're one of the coastal communities, so yeah, we get kind of that same weather that, you know, the Northwest gets.
So what can we do for John in the, maybe not the frozen North, but the frozen Southeast?
I wanted to talk to you about my cherry tree. We moved here about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. and that first summer in 2008, our cherry tree gave us about 5 cherries. It's a tart cherry tree, and there's lots and lots of pie cherry trees in Southeast Alaska, lots in Haines.
Right.
But our poor tree wasn't doing anything for us. So that following spring, I did a heavy pruning.
Good.
We got a little bit of a harvest, about 3 quarts within 2 years. I pruned it slightly 2 more times. And every fall, we do feed the drip area of the tree with a lot of seaweed. We get a lot of seaweed in the area here, so we mm-hmm. use it on our gardens. And last year, we got some cherries, but I didn't harvest. And this year, the tree exploded. I've gathered 3 gallons so far. Friends have gathered another 2 gallons. And I got friends coming over today to pick more, and I'll be picking more. So it's infinite cherries right now.
Now, when you moved in, the tree was there?
The tree was here. It was, you know, almost about the same size as it is now, but it was kind of a mess. So I just did a really heavy pruning that the second spring. It's grown a lot since then, kind of filled out a lot.
And you want to know why you're suddenly getting a lot of cherries.
Yeah, exactly. You know, why so many cherries this year?
Couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, your rejuvenation pruning did exactly what you hoped it would do. And my understanding is that kind of a rejuvenation pruning, where you take an old tree and try to bring it back to bearing life, you tend to see the results about 2 or 3 years after that.
Mm.
Your use of your seaweed, which is seaweed yep. from cold waters, provides mm-hmm. micronutrients that people in my part of the country and down south can't even dream about. You have to get all the way up to like the rocky coast of Maine before the water mm-hmm. is cold enough to provide the kind of seaweed that has these incredible plant rejuvenation powers.
Interesting.
I would also suggest to you that if you missed a really good harvest 1 year, that don't forget cherry trees, both your sour cherry or tart cherry or pie cherry, and the mm-hmm. sweet cherries that only grow in warm weather climates. People need to realize you need a very specific climate to grow sweet eating cherries. But all the trees flower very early in the season. I mean, the cherry trees along the Potomac, along the East River Drive in Philadelphia, these are very early flowering trees. And if you get a really hard frost at exactly the right time, you can lose what would have been an even bigger harvest than you got this year.
That is very, very interesting what you just said there. Generally, we'll get some sort of frost in May. This tree flowers in May here. But this May, we had and this has been a very, very wet summer, but the 2 weeks in May were beautiful, lots of sun, and we had no frost the whole May, which is strange for here.
And that equals the maximum amount of cherries. It's not that you got a lot of cherries this year. The sad part is you actually had the potential for that many cherries maybe the previous couple of years. But you're always going to be in danger of frost. Now, how tall is the tree?
It's probably 14 or 15 feet.
That's a very easy size. You know, cherries tend to get very large. So here's what you can do next year.
Mm-hmm.
Get a couple of old strings of Christmas lights, not modern LED super efficient Christmas
right.
light. You want the old C5, C7s, the ones that give off heat. Light the tree up for Christmas and then leave the lights up in the tree and then follow the weather. If the tree is about to burst into flower or recently burst into flower and you're going to get a sudden frost, turn the lights on and leave the lights on. It'll provide enough warmth to get the tree through that period. And in the odd sensation, in the odd unlikelihood that it would have been dry coming up to the frost, watering the tree will give it a little bit more frost potential. And the other thing is keep doing the seaweed. Plants that are fed with seaweed from cold waters have a frost tolerance of up to 5 degrees more than similar plants in the exact same spot not fed seaweed.
How do you like that? I had no idea.
It has remarkable micronutrient potential.
Interesting. I love the Christmas light idea.
All right, John, good luck, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Take it easy. Have a great day.
My pleasure. You take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. I'm calling from Fishtown in Philadelphia.
All right, a Fishtowner. Very good. What can we do for Laura in Fishtown?
I have a sizable perennial garden which contains trees that have been in the ground for 2 years, trees that have been in the ground for 10 years, shrub roses, a bunch of bulbs, and some other perennial plants. And in addition, I have another area of my garden that has established blueberries. The situation is that a developer is interested in my perennial garden, not to keep it as a garden. And I wanted to know about the wisdom of trying to move all these different perennial plants and trees that I have.
Okay, so did you own that or did Oh, okay.
Well, we own it, but it's going to be probably developed, I would think, early next year.
And the person who's buying it clearly has no interest in these plants.
Not at all.
Okay,
no, not
right.
At all.
It's not like somebody buying your home where the landscaping is part of the sale. Now, but the sale is not final yet?
No, not at all.
I mean, because timing is everything here, honey.
That's what I was concerned about.
And do you have new homes for these strays? You know, this is a no-kill radio show.
Well, I have a lot of friends who are into the tree planting with the Philadelphia Horticulture Society, and
yeah,
I have another
but
friend.
That's different than what we're talking about, the tree tenders and the tree planters and the street tree people, yeah.
Right. I want to try to do whatever I can to preserve these plantings.
Well, you got to work backwards. You got to find the homes first.
Okay.
You know, it's difficult to dig up trees that haven't been planted in a way that makes it easy to move them later on. That's something where once we get into the fall and the trees start to go dormant, once they go fully dormant, that's something you can then offer to your tree planting friends if they want to attempt it. So what I'm hearing is the blueberries.
Right.
Which right now are in fruit?
They're finishing up, right.
Okay. Now, when all the leaves are off and we get to the dormant part of winter, that is a time where you could dig these plants up. Again, once they've lost all their leaves and they've gone dormant, you can dig these plants up. And blueberries, I think you'd have a much better chance of moving to a new location. Now, ideally, of course, the spring would be better. If you can wait till spring, then what I would say is go out on the first nice day of spring and give them a really hard pruning. Reduce them in size by half, because I'm presuming these are like 5 foot high bushes at this point.
Yes.
Yeah. In the spring, I would reduce their size by half and then dig them up and move them. And the only reason I'm pruning them that hard is to make them easier to move. One thing people don't understand is the considerable weight of the root ball that they have to move. You can't shake all the dirt off the roots and expect these things to travel well. You have to move them. What you have to do is get a bunch of shovels, create an island around them where their roots are still in this island of soil, and then you get a couple of people to lift that up onto a tarp, and then you move the tarp to its new location. And if you're driving, it really needs to be in an enclosed vehicle. They can't sit in the back of a pickup truck and drive 30 miles to northeast Philly, or they'll be wind-whipped to death.
Okay. Now, is it going to be helpful that the fact that the blueberries are in a raised bed?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Their roots are going to come up much easier.
Okay.
And one of the first things you need to do now, too, because those blueberries, I mean, they're yours. See if there's possibly a spot you can get in a community garden where you could transfer them and have your blueberry patch in a community garden.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I actually have one across the street.
Low-hanging fruit, honey. If you carry them on a tarp across the street in the springtime, where you can keep an eye on them and water them really well if it doesn't rain, your chance of success should be close to 100.
All right. That's so helpful. It's made my day to hear that you can keep some of this stuff going on.
All right. Well, good luck.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Have a good day. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you for asking, sir. Where is Tom Wonderful?
Well, I am currently in Kansas. I'm doing a job up here, but I listened to your radio last weekend, and I wanted to get some information on crepe myrtles, but I'm originally from Florida.
Okay. And where are your crepe myrtles?
Well, they're in my front yard. They're in the north panhandle of Florida,
right,
around the Destin Beach area.
Okay.
And I've got three large crepe myrtles. They stand around probably 20 feet tall. They are just reaching the power lines that are running.
Oh, man. You know, you planted them in the wrong spot. And, of course, you want to know, can you commit crepe murder and whack them down to around 2 feet tall?
Well, the first few years that I owned the house, I had the house built in 2000, mm-hmm. and the crepe myrtles, of course, were small. And I often see this done in that area of Florida, that they chop them all the way back to just the trunk, and then the next year they come back, of course, smaller, but they still flower. So I did it over the years, and until somebody mentioned to me that I'm really doing the plant more harm than good.
And you noticed also that the plants began to lose their symmetry. Their trunks were huge and their branches were small. You eventually wind up with a skinny arm coming out of an elephant's foot.
Exactly. And they kind of look like that now, but because of the last 4 or 5 years I haven't done that, the branches now have become taller and more symmetrical because, as you said, every year they get thicker. So now it looks a little bit more symmetrical. But my main concern is being able to trim them back that's going to do the plant good versus just...
Yeah. No, I understand. Now, how close are they to the power lines, though?
Well, the power company comes out and trims them back at their leisure whenever they seem to feel that it's getting prohibitive.
Right.
But they're not encroaching on the power lines very much because they're not that large of a plant.
Okay.
Not like a large oak tree or anything like that.
And are you going to do the work?
Well, it depends on how high I can get with just a standard ladder and a garden tool that can just reach up there to saw them off.
Right. The ideal situation with crepe myrtles is where you are, they don't have a true period of dormancy, but they do lose their flowers, right, over the course of the winter?
Yes, they do. They lose their flowers and their leaves, and they, yeah, you're probably right. They don't have a true sense of dormancy like you would if they were up in the northern part.
No, but you have... You still have the visual cues. That's good. So the ideal time to cut them back would be, quote, the middle of winter, which I realize you don't have, through early spring, because I presume that they begin growing again pretty actively in, like, April.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We've got a little bit of a winter, but not a heavy freeze,
right,
not at all.
So
okay.
Ideally... After that little bit of winter, once they've started to grow again, the ideal situation is to remove 2 feet a year. That actually improves the number of flowers, the quality of the flowers, and year after year keeps the plant to the same height. If, for instance, you had started to do this when they were 8 feet tall every spring, just removing 2 feet, they'd still be 8 feet tall. And they'd look perfect.
Gotcha.
So you can do more than that, but the closer you'd come to that ideal, obviously if there's a safety factor involved, if you can only get up so high to prune them safely, that's where you're going to prune them. And you're going to do it again after all chance of frost is done in your area. And then you would do that same thing every year, so you'd never be facing the situation of them being too tall. And over the course of a couple of years, whether it's 8 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet, or 15 feet, over the course of a couple of years, the plant is going to re-achieve that symmetry. So the basic rule to avoid crepe murder is to literally take off every spring as much as the tree grew the previous year, kind of keeping the plant in a stasis so the flowers are always at the right height for you to appreciate. And pruning really does improve the flowering on this plant tremendously.
Absolutely, because I have noticed over the years that I haven't pruned it at all, the flowers are very minimal now.
Some plants just really like a haircut, and butterfly bush and crepe myrtle are two of the poster children for that. They flower better if they get some of their growth removed in the early spring. Now, at other times a year, you can do tremendous harm pruning the plant, so that is the ideal time and gives you time to plan for it.
All righty. Thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and apologize for some confusing shorthand that the dirt doctor, Howard Garrett, and I lapsed into during a very important interview segment that we recently repeated on the show. While discussing the naturally occurring soil organism that prevents mosquito breeding, both Howard and I started saying BT instead of BTI. That is incorrect. The organic pesticide, known just as BT, controls caterpillars. If you're looking for clever mosquito control, you want BTI. But don't go looking for all the details under M for mosquitoes in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to feed your lawn to make it green, but keep your drinking water clear. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Summit Responsible Solutions. Summit Mosquito Dunks and Mosquito Bits contain BTI, which naturally controls mosquitoes without harming other living things, including people and pets. Online at summitresponsiblesolutions.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. It's almost lawn feeding time, and we have a wonderful example in the news recently of what happens when you overfeed your lawn, unless you didn't know Toledo couldn't drink its water for several days. We'll tell you about the connection between your fall feeding and having green water after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ruth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Ruth. How are you?
I'm just fine.
And where is Ruth just fine?
I'm in Traverse City, Michigan, the cherry capital of the world.
And one of the first areas to pick up our show when we went national many, many years ago. I have a great fondness for your area. What can we do for Ruth in Traverse City?
I got some very nice hens and chicks this summer and planted them in a plastic strawberry planter. It looks like terracotta, but it's plastic. And I'm concerned about whether those hens and chicks will survive our Michigan winter out on my third floor balcony.
Right. One of the problems with any plant in a pot is wintertime. The same plant that will thrive if it has its roots in the ground will often die because its roots freeze when it's above the ground in a planter. Now, you'd be doomed if it was true terracotta, because those are guaranteed to chip and flake and crack and break as soon as the freeze-thaw cycle starts. The basic answer... Let me tell you a quick story, because I don't think I've ever told this story on the air, and it's one of my favorite memories. When my children were small, we went down to Wildwood, which is the Shore Resort here in the Philadelphia area, Wildwood, New Jersey. And we were lucky enough to be able to rent the penthouse in the condos at the very end of the boardwalk, which gave us access to the roof, where there was a roof garden. And on this roof garden were very low-growing, huge concrete planters filled with hens and chicks. And they did stay out there over the winter and did survive, although some years we could tell that there had been some winter kill over the winter before we got back there in July or August. Now, this is in New Jersey, which is 100 times warmer than you, right on the ocean, which moderates the temperatures, and the planters were low to the ground and not exposed to the wind because there was a wall around. So I'm thinking your planter would be exposed to the wind completely. It's not like an enclosed balcony with glass or anything.
No, it isn't.
How crazy, how stupid would it be to bring it inside? I realize if you have a balcony, you're probably living in a condo or an apartment.
I'm in a condo.
Do you have garages or anything downstairs?
No.
Storage areas?
Of course, a sliding glass door to the balcony.
First of all, if you can bring it inside and put it on a big dish and just let it sit there, it'll be fine. If you leave it outside, it will freeze to death. And even these plastic containers can crack when the freeze-thaw cycle is immense. But hens and chicks are very strong. So
I know. I've had them in rock gardens before.
Yeah, exactly. And if you were on the first floor and you could put them in a low container behind a wall, they might make it. But by bringing them inside and not fussing with them, not trying to give them extra light or water or anything like that, you might induce some blooms. The blooms on these things are amazing. You could also just put them in a closet, literally, and let them go dormant. Or take them to a friend's house and put it in a basement that doesn't freeze. And they would just go dormant.
Well, that's a good idea.
But I think the one thing you don't want to do is leave them sit out there. I think you'd not only lose the plants, you'd lose the pot.
Okay.
And I think they'd be perfectly acceptable house plants. I mean, they don't need a ton of light. I think they're used to naturally going dormant over the winter. If you bring them inside, I'd put them in the coolest part of your apartment and water them very sparingly. All you want to do... It is keep them alive until spring, kind of like your entire state does with its humans.
Well, thank you very much. You've been so helpful.
All right, Ruth.
It.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. 1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well.
And where is Michael doing well?
I'm doing well in Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Michael in New Jersey?
We built a home brand new about 3 years ago. And when we did this, the builder was supposed to put in good soil on top of the still dirt around our property. Unfortunately, we were gone that stretch of days.
Oh, bad timing, Kemosabe.
Yeah, totally. So, and we had ordered all the zoysia grass, and we had that installed, and the zoysia grass is so absolutely tough that it had no problem growing on top of the soil. But as we planted trees, we found that the trees were not doing so well as compared to the zoysia. So I dug up the ground a little bit, and I noticed that all of our ground seems to be the orange still dirt and not the good soil that we were supposed to have.
Right.
So we had 5 Royal Frost birch planted. 3 of those 5 have died. The other 2 look like they're on their way out as well. And we also planted a thornless honey locust last year, and when I did that, I tried to dig down as deep as I could, a couple feet, and I made the perimeter around the mulching of the tree extra large. I put good soil in there as well as mulched everything. And this spring, I put in compost as well as mulch on top of that. And even this week, we noticed that the thornless honey locust, the leaves seem to be yellowing. It's not a lot yet, but definitely about 20 or 30 leaves we've noticed this week. And the Royal Frost birch just do not seem to be thriving.
Now, did you plant the birch trees?
No, we hired somebody to install them. They used good dirt. They used compost. They added some holly cone fertilizer as well.
Okay,
seemed,
so
it's a reputable company that seems to know what they're doing.
Yeah, but, oh, right. And that's why all their trees are dead.
Yeah, well, I didn't know if it was because of what they did or if it's because the soil is just so bad around the entire yard.
No, the problem was they might not have removed the wrappings from around the tree. That's a big mistake that a lot of people make. But everything you've described to me to try to counteract the poor soil is something that will lead to the early demise of a tree. When you have poor soil or good soil, you always want to plant a tree high in the ground, not low. I realize the instinct is to stabilize it by planting it deeper and deeper. But what you do is you cover up part of the bark of the tree, and then insects or just water rots that bark away in a complete circle, and the tree dies. So when you're going to plant new trees, which you should do in the fall is the absolute best time, you want to make sure that the trees can survive poor soil, which most trees can if they're planted correctly. And that is much higher in the ground than you are comfortable with. You make a wide hole, not a deep one, so that the bad soil is broken up in all directions, but the root flare of the tree will be above the soil line. And you don't improve the soil in the hole. That's a chump move, because then the roots are going to girdle. They're going to stay in that nice island of good soil, and they're not going to find their way out into the crappy soil around them. You got to give them no choice but the crappy soil. So you loosen it all up. You plant the tree high. You improve the soil in the hole, not one bit. It's all whatever's in there. And then when you're done planting, you mulch the tree with 1 or 2 inches of compost. No wood mulch, no bark, no root mulch. No, I can't believe it's not butter mulch. None of this junk that they won't landfill anymore. Just 1 or 2 inches of compost going out as far as you can. And then you take a hose, and each tree that gets planted gets 24 hours of that hose just set to the slowest possible drip at the base of the tree to really saturate the soil. And then do that again for a couple of hours every week. We don't get good rain. And I don't care how bad your soil is, your trees will thrive.
Okay.
All right, man?
Thank you so much.
You have a plan for success now.
I appreciate it, Mike. I really enjoy your show as well.
Thank you. And don't feel bad. The mistakes that they made and you made are the most common mistakes, and that's why I get to do this instead of going out and finding a real job.
Lucky you.
All right. Good luck, Michael.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Take the Toledo lesson to heart and feed your lawn sanely. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, s'il vous plaît.
Sure, Mike. Glenn in Manassas, Virginia writes, I applied fertilizer to my fescue lawn in the middle of July, right before it was supposed to storm. It did not storm. Now I have huge yellow spots in my backyard. Will the grass eventually grow back in those spots?
Probably not. It's likely that Glenn is going to have to spread some fresh seed there. Fescue grasses have many advantages. They can take some shade and require less food and care, but they are clumping grasses that can't grow sideways to fill in dead areas the way bluegrass can. I'd be out looking for matching seed right now so he can repair those spots during the ideal seeding window, which is kind of right now, mid-August through September.
Matching seed?
Yes, as our lawn care guru, Iowa State turf grass professor Dr. Nick Christians, explained to me years ago, you can't buy seed to make lawn repairs based on the type of grass alone. Bluegrass isn't always blue, and there are many varieties of fescue. The existing grass in Glenn's lawn, for instance, may be dark green with blunt blades, while the grass that grows from a bag that just says fescue may be pointy and a lighter color, even though they're both, quote, true fescues.
So if the new seed doesn't match the existing grass, you'll get a patchwork quilt.
Exactly. But more importantly here, upcoming storm or no storm, cool season lawns like bluegrass and fescue should never be fed in the summer. They don't need it, and it can burn the grass. Oh, I guess Glenn knows that now.
That was mean.
No, it wasn't, or isn't, or anyway, if it had stormed, almost all of that fertilizer would have been driven directly into the Chesapeake Bay. This kind of thoughtless use of fertilizer has to stop, or we're all going to wind up like Toledo, where fertilizer runoff made their city water supply toxic and undrinkable earlier this month.
Do you know for a fact that Glenn used chemical fertilizer?
Oh, yeah. When Glenn copped to spreading fertilizer on his former lawn in the ill-advised month of July, I asked exactly what he was using on his poor fescue. In the spring and summer, he replied, he uses a weed-in feed with an NPK rating of 30.03. For the fall feeding, the numbers on the bag are 24, 25, and 1.
Yikes. Those numbers seem really high. Can you explain what they mean?
Basically, all fertilizers have to have three numbers on the label. The first refers to the nitrogen content, which is the primary food for non-flowering plants like lawns and sweet corn. The third number is the potassium content. The middle number indicates the amount of phosphorus, the chemical most often implicated in problems like the toxic algae bloom that made Toledo's water undrinkable.
Ah, is that why dishwashing and laundry detergent say no phosphorus on the label?
Yes. There's been a concerted effort to try and lower the amount of P getting into our waterways for quite some time. That's why Glenn's fall fertilizer, the one with that startlingly high phosphorus number, has recently become illegal to sell or use in Maryland or Virginia.
It's actually illegal?
Yes. New laws now in effect in both Maryland and Virginia have essentially banned the use of phosphorus on lawns unless a soil test shows the need for it. And even if a test did show low levels, his fertilizer would still be way too full of it. And both of the fertilizers he used also contain way too much nitrogen, three times what any lawn needs. In fact, both qualify as high explosives. Placed into an artillery shell, those fertilizers would have the potential to do considerable damage. Do people really think it's wise to apply high explosives to the lawn they and their family are going to be walking on?
People need to realize that these chemicals don't stay on their lawn.
No, they get into the local drinking water, and in Glenn's D.C. area case, further degrade the Chesapeake Bay. In other areas, they ruin lakes and pollute rivers. You can blame farmers all you want, and they do share quite a bit of the guilt. But studies consistently show that homeowners apply 4 times as much fertilizer per square foot as the average farmer. As Pogo Possum once famously said, we have met the enemy, and he is us.
So should people just not feed their lawns?
No, of course not. These new laws and similar laws in many other states simply reduce the levels to reasonable amounts. Cool season lawns thrive on a twice-yearly feeding with a fertilizer whose label numbers read in the neighborhood of 10-0-0. Higher numbers are dangerous, unnecessary, and now possibly illegal.
Isn't corn gluten meal right around that number?
Yes, it is. And there are many other types of bagged organic fertilizers. And lawns love a compost feeding in the fall. Safe and sane lawn care just takes a change in attitude and a desire to do the right thing. If you need an incentive, just remember Toledo. Unless you like toxic algae blooms making your drinking water look like a green smoothie. Well, that sure was a hard look at lawn care designed to make you feel all guilty about overfeeding, now wasn't it? Mommy, Mommy, why is our water all green and funky? Luckily for you's what now got religion, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to lots of previous articles about safe and sane lawn care, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer has threatened to phosphorize me if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email and your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please, please tell us your location. Please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is phosphorus-free Al Banks. Alexis, I don't even have a lawn. Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Tricia Whiting, known to her friends as Trixie, is studying lawns in Korea. Don't drink the water, Trix. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki. Well, he's still not up yet. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, saying don't cut your lawn too short. Don't collect the clippings. Don't turn your drinking water green. And I'll see you next week. Vicious, biting, and really big, the horsefly is one of the nastiest pests of summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll try and help a family under attack by these bird-sized biters. Plus your fabulous phone calls.